I wanted to talk on a slightly different topic that I think can and should be integrated into the discussions about built environment and aging. I want to talk some about the considerations for the aging workforce. It's an area that I've been interested in for the past 15 years and struggling to understand. Denny Dobbins in the audience is one of the inveterate actors in this field who just continues to feel like we can do better, and I appreciate his pushing me along the way. What's the way for moving forward? Is it zero?
Arrow.
You mean the standard way? Okay. I found this on a roadside in England, and I, when I'm talking mostly to folks who are dealing not so much with aging, but with work, the concern I have is that this is the sort of the stereotypical view of the older worker, stooped over elderly people that are having difficulty making it across the street, and that's what the warning sign's about. But there are also photos of people like this, who's a coal miner at the age of 38, who is suffering from silicosis and would in fact die 8 months later. And I ask the question, is this an older worker? These are sweatshop workers in a garment shop in Thailand, I believe, and they're in their mid-30s for the most part, and I ask, are they older workers? These are construction workers in one of the Middle Eastern countries, and I ask you, are they older workers? And then I like to show this photo of my father at the age of 90, who was still teaching epidemiology at the University of Michigan School of Public Health. And I ask, is he an older worker? Those, that little photographic display is really designed to change my mind about talking about older workers. I'm really talking about aging workers. When we're talking about aging workers, you start aging the day you start working. As a worker, you start aging the day you're born. And I think it's important to keep that in mind as we think about this process. There is no point at which we become old. It is a process of aging, and we need to adapt to it throughout life. And we need to think about the environment in which we adapt throughout the aging process, not simply once a person reaches some threshold of 55 or 65 or 75 or what have you. With regard to aging and work, what I want to talk about is very briefly about this topic, demographics. Some of this will be completely familiar to you. Workplace stressors and some of the trends in that and what we need to make of these. Work capacity and age, and it follows very well along the line of what presentation we just heard with regard to aspects of changing capacities. Work performance and workability, and what we know about that and aging and what we can do about that, and then a little bit about aging workers in the built environment. So demographics. Percent of the workforce age 55 plus has been changing. It actually reached its nadir in 1990 and now has been remarkably increasing, so that we're at 20% of the workforce is now age 55 and over. This workforce 55 plus, there is no end of it, depending upon the work environment and your social and economic situation. People work till they die. What about the growth of the U.S. workforce in the last 10 years? And this is projected dramatically in the next 10 years as well. Notice the particular decrease in the proportion of the workforce, which is age 35 to 44. The biggest growth is in the age of 55 to 64, and we are having a rather striking growth in 65 plus in the workforce. And you notice that the younger workforce is smaller. It's partly because of the baby bust following the baby boom, and it's partly because of the economy, which is leading to the reduction in number of jobs. And if you aren't in the workforce to start with, you don't get into the workforce. But what's also happening, a consequence of a number of things, the economy being one of those, is the percent planning to put off retirement until after age 62. The survey that was done in 2005 from Gallup shows the increasing proportion of people who are intending to put off retirement until after age 62 has been rather strikingly increasing from about 35% in 1998 to over 55% in 2004. And there's a diversity in the aging workforce in I recently found evidence of through the Sloan Center at Boston College, showing the trends in the proportion of those greater than 55 in the full-time workforce among Hispanic, the yellow color, black, the orange color, whites, the white color, and other, which is the mix of those which we can't identify or which are other less well-represented groups. And the interesting thing is the fact that the trends are the same in the workforce for those increasing over 55 in the full-time workforce, except a dramatic increase among blacks. And that's related as much to socioeconomic condition as anything else, but it's just an example of where diversity plays out in this environment. What about trends in workplace physical stressors? The workplace, particularly in US, Western Europe, is getting increasingly service-oriented, not manufacturing-oriented, isn't it? Therefore, physical stressors ought to be reduced. Well, it's interesting to see that they really aren't. On the left is the change in intense noise. This is a survey done in the EU by the European Foundation. Every 5 years, they survey the workforce now in 28 countries, and they come up with, among other things, issues having to do with the work environment that are reported by the workers. And those who are reporting work more than 25% of the time exposed to intense noise has been gradually increasing over the last 20 years from about 25 to 30%. This slide is a little distorted because I can't get the newest version of PowerPoint to behave. I'm sure others of you have had that problem. And I don't really consider that an aging problem. I consider that a problem with Microsoft. But let me go to the next one. I think I can see it. Yeah. The second group is repetitive motions, which is really striking, over 40%, and if anything, increasing. The third one is handling heavy loads, over 30%, and if anything, increasing. And the fourth one is tiring positions, which is increasing. This is reference to the fact that despite the fact that manufacturing is leaving Western Europe and the United States, the nature of the service economy is not a non-physical economy. And so that's important to understand with respect to the workforce that has to experience in that, and particularly the aging workforce. This is information that has to do with a different aspect of the trends, the nature of the work contract. Permanent employment, as we know, is becoming less and less common as the norm, pardon me, in the West, so that the yellow is permanent employment, the standard contract that we're familiar with. The orange is fixed term employment, which is essentially a contract employment, maybe a long-term contract, but it's a contract employment. The key issue here is it's not associated with benefits. And then the third is the temporary workforce, which is that those who are in and out of the workforce, in and out of work environments, that is increasingly represented in the nature of work contracts, and especially for lower socioeconomic groups. The stressors in these environments, repetitive tasks, repetitive movements, and painful, tiring work postures, are all increase according to the type of that contract, which suggests something about the power of the worker in that work environment to affect the nature of those kinds of exposures. So what do we know about work capacity and aging? The types of evidence I want to very quickly review for you are physical capacity, mental capacity, and performance and experience associated with aging. In physical capacity, maximal strength occurs at 20 to 30 years. It's always disappointing to see this. Explosive physical efforts, those which are the most dramatically physically demanding at work, are the most affected in the course of aging. And older adults, as a rule, work much closer to their capacity with respect to the physical modalities. What's interesting, though, is if we have to ask about physical capacity, is can older workers keep up? Their capacities can be matched to the job, but it's very uncommon to consider changes in person or job over time or age. So whatever matching is done generally is not matched to capacity, and even if it is done, it's not rematched as capacities evolve over the course of a working lifetime. The other thing to understand is that work uncommonly demands maximal effort. So most jobs, most older workers can do, depending on, based on the physical demands of that job. What about mental capacity? We don't have a lot of good information about mental capacity and work and aging. Most of it is laboratory-based findings. Reaction time tends to be pretty stable up to around 60 or 65. There's not a lot of good evidence above that. It's certainly going to tail off, but we don't know at what rate because the population studies don't include those age ranges very well. Information retrieval is slower. It's slower, but not necessarily not possible to do. It's just a question of what the time taken to get the information back. Learning and recall are similarly slower. And perceptual information is, there's slower processing of it, but it still, for the most part, remains in the average working lifetime. So is the modern workplace too complex or too technical for older workers? What's interesting is those lab tests don't translate very well into the workplace. When you try to study whether those kinds of factors actually make a difference in a worker's ability to do the job, they don't translate well. And factors other than those that we can measure in the laboratory do play an important role in the ability of an individual to do mental work in the mental workplace, I mean in the workplace. And individual measures are quite sensitive to occupational class, so the information we have is very class-based and tends to be a middle or upper class-based database, evidence base that we use, and we apply it across all classes. Although we have a classless society, so it might not be relevant to the U.S. What do we know about performance of capacity and with respect to capacity and experience? What can older workers offer? Studies show that there is decreased performance for physically demanding work, for high-intensity paced work. Those studies have not been able to account for experience. I won't necessarily criticize those studies for being unable to account for experience. Experience is extremely hard to measure. You can measure time in job, but how you measure the increment in experience and how much incremental experience occurs is yet to be effectively measured scientifically reproducible way. So we need to account for experience, and we need still to try to figure out how to study that. But again, performance measures are rarely matched to capacity at any age. I took out of my presentation in this because of the time limits a study that a model that was presented, created by Peter Warr at the University of Sheffield, where he looked at the difference between aging and capacities and whether that aging capacity has a definite importance to the work and whether it and whether or not experience might matter. And he was able to show, and injury statistics document this association, that there are certain jobs where experience really matters and some of these capacities I just described don't matter so much, particularly in certain fairly regular mental or cognitive tasks where aging is, if anything, and it shows improved performance. There are the obvious physically demanding jobs where physical capacity is remarkably important, and then you will see aging deteriorating with it, and you'll see increase in injuries associated with it. But in between, there's a mix of these capacities and the value of experience, and it turns out that they're basically, they neutralize each other. They don't seem to affect the way the aging worker works in this environment. Which suggests that there's a lot of sort of internal understanding of the nature of different types of work that we have yet to really understand. There is an interesting approach to this that's been undertaken in Finland and is now being relatively widely used in Europe as a principle for managing how you look at the workplace and the workability of workers. It's how do we know what older workers can do? A lot of the early efforts of this were just medical rehabilitation measures or workplace-based measures, measures that don't have much robustness to them. But there are measures on a simple, those are measures on a simple 4 to 5 point scale. There is the workability index, however, that I want to call to your attention. This is an index developed in Finland. It's a self-reported score that individual workers are asked to provide. And they're asked to scale on a Likert scale their workability compared to their best workability. How do you feel your workability is now compared to what it was absolutely best? How your workability is related to the physical demands of your work and the mental or cognitive demands of your work, each on a scale of 1 to 5. What are the number of diseases that a physician has diagnosed and told you about that you have, and that's categorized in the groups between 1 and 7. What's your estimation of the impairment you have from those diseases? All self-report. Sickness absences in the past year, although that's available from company records, this was a self-report of sickness absences. What is your prognosis for your workability 2 years down the line? What trajectory are you on? And then what are the psychological resources in your work or your family environment to support you at work? Scale range 7 to 49. The rather interesting thing that the Finns did was then they did a study of a population of about 11,000 people, 6,000 of whom they were able to study for, follow for 11 years. And they looked at workability at the beginning of that time, grouped into excellent, good, moderate, or poor workability at the beginning. That was excellent is the lowest standard. Good is median to one standard deviation down, moderate is median to one standard deviation up, and then excellent and poor, the two standard deviations out. And there's a dramatic association with that workability measure and the disability pension awards, or leaving the workforce. So then the question comes, what do we do about affecting workability? Can we affect workability, or is it just something that happens? This study looked at a significant decline. What were the predictors of significant decline in workability index in the 11-year follow-up? And what they showed was decreased influence at work, something about job control, which you may have been reading in the literature, is increasingly identified as an important variable in work. Decreased satisfaction with the work tools, the ways in which you're able to do work. Increased ambiguity in work role and increased standing in one place. And then what about improving it? Can you actually improve workability? Decreased confusion in the work setting, decreased management strain, improved work postures, satisfaction with supervisor's attitude, and decreased repetitive movements. What's interesting is 3 out of 5 of those are management-related issues, not physical capacity issues. So there is much that can be done in the workplace that has to do with work organization to improve that work environment for older workers. The last thing I wanted to say is something very briefly about this issue about workforce and the built environment. What's remarkable, particularly in this country, is how far away work is located now from the living place, and we need to address locating housing or work closer so that people don't have to commute as far, and affordable housing in those locations, not just housing. And we have to facilitate safe transportation to work, adequate mass transit. That's no news to this audience, I'm confident. Matched capacities of work demands, these are the things that I've just told you about. I'll say one other thing. The built environment includes the workplace, and the workplace environment is not built very well for any age individual, but certainly not for the aging individual. So I think that when we think about built environment, it shouldn't just be the living community-based environment, it should also be the work environment. It's the whole sphere of how we engage with our environment as we try to live through our lives 24-hour days. So I'm going to skip these conversations to be more interesting. Thank you very much.
Well, now stay here, because I'm going to ask ask the three speakers to come back up and then see, open up the questions for everybody here. All right, who wants to be the first? Yes, in the back. I think we can hear you if you speak loudly.
My question is, Dr. Frank, when you were looking at the walkability of neighborhoods, did you consider accessibility for people using wheelchairs, people who might have mobility limitations?
In that study, we asked people their self-reported assessment of how walkable their neighborhood is, and the objectively measured data, there's no regional, I mean, we go, in that study, no, but in the newer studies where we're actually designing the studies intentionally to look at healthy aging, we actually go out into neighborhoods and audit communities. In fact, that's sort of the main focus. And so this is what we call micro-scale data collection, where we actually go around environments where people live. In that study, since it's healthy aging, we're not actually focusing on the work environment there mostly, but the lower age band does work, but we haven't really done micro-scale. So we go out into the field, we have a validated instrument, and we catalog every feature we can think of about the neighborhood, especially factors such as wheelchair access, anything to do with, basically there are links along block faces have characteristics, and then intersections have their own, and they're uniquely different, and then we summarize them, and we do what's called destination-based routes. So we pick where people live, and the nearest recreational destination, and the nearest utilitarian or place where they can shop. And then we catalog along that route, that pathway, or towards it. If they're in a really automobile-oriented place, we don't have the resources to go 5 miles along the suburban arterial. We just kind of go as far as in that direction we can. But that's critical. These factors will matter a lot, and they're also more modifiable. They're less expensive to fix, and they don't just matter for elderly, they matter for everybody, especially youth.
Given Dr. Wegman's presentation, I guess we should also have work as one of the places that people look about getting to.
For the general population, yes.
Other questions in the back? Yes.
Sure. There has been, obviously, a cultural divide, but there's also been a real lack of data to measure these things. So the consultant from Denver, who was there in Arkansas, was possibly subject to both of those, not aware. There's always been, the Clean Air Act is a health-based mandate. So in fact, transportation and public health have been connected for a long time, because the reason we have an air quality we regulate transportation investment based on the air pollution is not just because we care about the color of the air or how easy it is to see, but the National Ambient Air Quality Standards are based on health, right? So I think that the connection is there, and they were wrong, very wrong. But the non-motorized walking and biking, those trips has always been part of transportation planning, at least at some level. It certainly 5 years ago it was. So the connections are there. I think it's how they understand them. So the disconnect is decreasing, and there are tools, but mostly health impact assessment tools have been largely qualitative, perceptual things like how people perceive their neighborhood environment, or ways that they perceive that changes would be helpful, and they've not been really quantified that well. Now they are starting to be quantified. There's more and more evidence. I showed some today. There's a lot of other studies underway. So slowly, this evidence base is growing, and it provides a basis for health impact assessment to be conducted. And a week ago here in Denver, there was a meeting held by the Lincoln Institute of Land Policy, EPA, helped lead it. What region are we in? Region
8, I think.
Region 8, their office is leading it too. And also the Sonoran Institute, another, the Sonoran Institute is really kind of a foundation, really. And they got together and sort of are convening the creation of evidence-based tools to support decision-making, in effect, health impact assessment tools. And the good news is, we completed one 2 years ago in King County in Seattle where we took, and so what this means is there are lots of software platforms out there now, maybe lots, but five. Placeways, there's one called CommunityViz, iPlaces, like in the Index, there's a bunch of softwares that are actually being used in transportation and in planning so that you as a on a commission would be able, on a board, could say, okay, we've got this downtown redevelopment, here's six ways we can do it, how do they perform? And to get those health metrics into the performance criteria, it's very possible now. So the good news is it's happening, and if you're interested, I can share more. And Chris Kotichki is here, you might want to speak to it too. He's right there in front of you at CDC, he's involved in that.
I think Larry pretty much covered the fact that there were these two silos that did have implications for each other, but we haven't been historically, I think, for the last 16 or 15 years, with two exceptions between Berkeley and Columbia, been cross-educating really intensely the public health planning people. So you knew your health data or you knew your planning and transportation data, but you didn't really understand the dynamics and the way that public health people could use planning and transportation data and planning and transportation people could use health data, and didn't know what the big buckets of data that the other guy had even were. Things are getting better now, and it has to do with, I think, awareness and perception initially. Now, as we become more aware and perceive it, I think both systems can be improved and integrated, but there is already capacity that's not being tapped because of the lack of awareness.
Other questions? Bill.
So and it relates to universal design. You know, universal design is a design that ideally accommodates people across a wide spectrum of capacity. But I'm wondering how that might be effective given alternate circumstances. So everything is fine, or this design accommodates people across a wide level of capacity during normal times. But what about Katrina? Throw that into the mix. How might that then influence design and opportunities for evacuation and that sort of, I mean, is that even within the realm of research, or is that just too far out there, too difficult?
One of the other really enlightened people, go ahead.
I'm not sure I have a coherent answer to that. What I was thinking about as we've been talking here is my community, Lowell, Massachusetts, has a whole relatively well-maintained set of sidewalks which are useless in the winter because there's no plan to plow them. So in terms of emergency response, daily emergencies of just being able to get out to a drugstore or something are not possible for people trying to walk or who have to walk. I think it's I don't know whether there's a methodology for going about studying that, but actually I imagine scenario approaches could allow you to at least identify the elements.
There's a disaster preparedness is a large component of urban planning, and actually there's a great deal of work underway on that. And in fact, the issues are really, as you would expect, quite complex. It's if you're interested in it, I suggest you look at Phil Burke's work at Chapel Hill. And Stephanie Chang, who's a professor and works with him, and she's actually in my program at University of British Columbia, they do nothing but model and predict how disaster, different types of disasters, whether they be seismic or flood, or and look at how the design of infrastructure and communities affects the ability to respond and what the response would be. So they're just basically using expert systems. I think these are very advanced modeling tools, that can kind of predict how effectively you can respond to an event. But density and walkability concentrate people. So theoretically, it could, it could have a couple different effects. One is, without, what happens if we focus on the transit, we want to focus on transit, and the connection between public transportation and physical activity is very strong. I didn't even mention it today. But the best way we can promote physical activity we know of right now is actually probably investing in public transportation.
Right.
People who use transit actually are 3.5 times, we found already in another study, aren't really likely to walk or get the amount of physical activity recommended. So with that said, you then become a little bit vulnerable because you focus escape on or movement on a particular line or corridor. So I don't know the answers to this.
I'm only going to say one quick thing since I'm the moderator. I mean, there's been a lot with using GIS and mapping where isolated elders are with extreme heat events and having systems in place. And there have been a number of actually studies that have been done, I think, looking at different crises. They've looked at hurricanes and then what happened with flu and air quality. So we've had, I think, not a comprehensive plan, I think, studying mixtures and studying many things at once. I think Dr. Wegman even said at the National Academy workshop that we had, is probably the place where we do a very good job at studying one thing laser in on, and it's, I think, the system stuff that is trickier. I don't know if you want to say anything more about that. Or.
I think you just said.
Okay. All right. I know there's a whole bunch of hands. Yes, Denny.
Just curious, because we've got one foreign country here, Canada, we've heard about it. It's not like
and Finland. We heard Finland.
But British Columbia, right?
Yeah.
Well, we also have Europe and what's going on there. Whole world is aging, is it not? I think the baby boom is global. So what if we learn from other countries besides Canada, from Europe and Asia about aging and its impact on the future of all of y'all?
It's an easy question. I'm going to give that one to anyone on the panel.
Or,
I mean,
I think if you look at it, the way we live makes a difference, especially if you're looking at different cultures. Although the influence of Western society is also impacting very much on the Eastern society. In the past, the elderly population lived with their children. Okay, so that sort of helped come away from some of the emergency situations, daily support, and things that were needed were available. And I think it is very, very difficult because that younger generation in Eastern society is also looking for more independence from the older adults. As a result, they are kind of moving out and leaving them in isolation. So that is a big, big challenge. And I think unless we have a support system within our communities, that even if you are living in a community, if you don't have people nearby who are accessible and can provide help, I think it is going to be a big challenge. The other challenge about the emergency preparedness that you're talking about, I think the sense of smell plays a very vital role, and especially the gasoline leakage, because they may not even sense it. Here you have created an environmental hazard that they may not even know it, that there's gas is leaking in the apartment they are living in. And that could create an emergency situation that we didn't have yet.
One thought that occurs to me when you're describing the historical structure of more community-based, family-based organizations, and how we have certainly in this country moved increasingly away from that kind of organization. It strikes me we're setting up a trap for ourselves to perpetuate that even more effectively by the development of electronic devices that allow for distance management of family needs, which in itself will create a conflict with the needs of community and the associated needs of the open market.
Gentleman over here, yes.
I'd like to ask a distinguished panel if there has been work done in the built environment with respect to injuries. So we know that there's loss of senses, as
didn't mention, but I think is, but I was thinking of proprioception.
Yeah.
And the importance of proprioception in the workplace can't be overemphasized. I'm sure that's true in the general community environment too. I think there's an awful lot of knowledge out there. Whether there's a systematic approach to using that knowledge is something I'm less familiar with.
There's a lot of work done on one of the first things that indicators out of the gate in health impact assessment is traffic safety, pedestrian safety in particular. And so, elderly fit very prominently into that work. Need to. So the question is how effective has that been? So I didn't fully understand your question though. So I think I might have gotten only part of it, but I think you're asking about how safety and injury prevention related to built environment.
For example, we're encouraging people to walk more, but when we encourage people to walk more, their risk of falls increases.
Okay.
So do we have some research and how to better design that sidewalks?
I think probably Bill Satriano would be able to answer better because that's really getting into ergonomics and other. Yeah.
No, I was just going to say that I think you touch on a critical issue, and it gets back to how we kind of silo things.
Mm-hmm.
That there's a tremendous move to encourage older people to leave their homes and engage in walking, but I really don't think we've given enough attention to the extent to which we're elevating the risk of an outdoor fall, at least for some segment of that group. And there's some recent papers on the whole area of research on falls that most of the attention has been given to indoor falls,
mm-hmm.
which is associated with frailty.
Right.
The irony is that most of the environmental work on falls has been done indoors for less attention than outdoors, and that's precisely where we need, so I think you've identified very
There's a lot of opportunity in a more walkable place with eyes on the street and more community and people nearby. I mean, that's the isolation effect. We didn't talk about depression and social isolation and all that, which does figure in. It's very.
I just have to do one plug for Eleanor Smith, who talks about visitability, and that could be in the workplace, and it can be at the home, and having a zero-step entrance, too. So, I mean, avoiding steps, I mean, the things that, and also doing the walking audits for, incomplete sidewalks or dangerous sidewalks or barriers. But, Denny, you were going
to
say something?
Just to add on this, for injuries, it's interesting, in our separate silos, the falls is a big problem among the elderly, whatever
we are.
We are. However, that's defined. And it's also a big problem in construction workers.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been a tremendous effort mm-hmm. in the construction industry,
mm-hmm.
OSHA and NIOSH, to try to look at ways of reducing that. It's a huge problem. And I wonder if there's not things we could learn from each other.
That's an excellent point. Excellent. Yeah. Okay, Bill and then Chris, only because I'm sorry.
Larry appropriately indicated the importance of the grid pattern and how we know there's an association between people who reside in that type of setting and kind of those people tend to walk more. Then we have the kind of the catch-22 of the intersection. The intersection is, in fact, you indicated that one way you can measure the grid pattern is count the intersection, but that's also a sign of a lot of injury, not only for walkers, pedestrians, but drivers, and the danger that older drivers experience when they try to make a left-hand turn into oncoming traffic, and how issues of depth perception and how depth perception declines elevates the risk of injury. So that would seem to be a prime area for design, and I'm sure that you're going to say you're going to identify all the studies that have been done actually.
Well, actually, I think one thing we do know is that in a gridded network, the transportation is distributed more evenly, and because the intersections are spaced close together, the speed of vehicles is actually much lower. So it's actually one of the ways to calm traffic is actually to create more intersections and create more dispersion of traffic across a grid. So that actually results in a safer, and also the intersections tend to be in a more walkable neighborhood where there's more intersections, narrower, so you can get across the street quicker. So the problem is those you may only have two intersections you need to cross in a more automobile-dependent environment, but those are often seas of asphalt that actually are literally barriers, like walls that elderly cannot even ever get across.
Satya wanted to say something.
I think the most important thing is that all of these changes require infrastructure change. And if you think about it, when technology was dumped on us initially, the computers, do you think all the offices changed the furniture for the computers that were put in? No. They gave you the same desk that you worked at before, no changes. The lighting was not affected. The computer screen was being bombarded by the light on that one, glare problems and everything. And slowly that environmental, modifications were made. But the key things that are happening is, at workplace, yes, you can find changes. The only difference is you have to ask for it. So when you ask for it, they will be under the Disabilities Act, so many things. So there are changes coming along slowly. Now, there are other infrastructural changes that do not require a whole lot of expense, but we just don't even pay attention to it. Even the cross-section that we are talking about, the improving the contrast. All you need, the yellow paint on the edges, okay? We have it at certain places, but not at every intersection. Just that alone can improve the contrast and allow people not to fall down. Now, think of multiple sensory impairments, not just one, because that all of the senses affect us one way or the other. So if you have a hearing impairment and somebody is honking, you may not even hear it, and you walk right into that. So I think we have to take into consideration all multiple senses. And yes, we can't rip open all the streets and do that, but there are certain things that we can do with least investment on our part and minimize some of those issues.
I know we're going over time, but I'm going to let Chris get the final word quickly.
One of the things we're dealing with is that we've gotten into these self-reinforcing negative cycles. People aren't physically active, they're not as far out, and so they have balance issues that might actually be partially addressed by being more physically active. Plus, if they're not out there being pedestrians, then the motor vehicle users and others aren't sensitized. And unfortunately, there probably will be a period when we try to reverse the cycle where some set of people who are the early adopters will mathematically be at some greater risk while they're redeveloping the balance and the physical capacity that they still have the potential to have, and we're re-educating the world about being aware of people with different functional capacities. But hopefully that, if we do this right, that period of time will be short, and then we'll be in hopefully a positive self-reinforcing loop where people are staying physically active longer and the world is more aware of all kinds of different levels of functionality.
Very good. Well, I want to have everyone thank the panelists. We have an excellent panel today.